And our special guest tonight, Dr. Raymond Moody, and we'll be back with him. Another great hour of discussion before your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We're with Dr. Raymond Moody. Raymond, you've developed a method based on the ancient Greeks of calling up the deceased. Tell me about this. How does it work? How did you even think about this?
Well, you know, this is one of those things that this is too weird for the National Enquirer. I mean,
but not for us.
That's right. But this is, number one, absolutely factual. And yet just too incredible to believe. But those of you, for example, who've read back in college, you remember reading Plato's Apology, which is the story of Socrates' trial. And the Phaedo, the other dialogue, is the story of Socrates' execution. Well, you might remember that what Socrates says that people really had against him was that they said he was a person who probed into things up in the air and down under the earth. And that was just what the average Greek believed that a philosopher was a person who the probing up into the air meant flying out of the body, like out of body travel and so on, or getting up into the air magically. And things under the earth meant calling up the spirits of the dead. People really believed that philosophers were people who evoked the spirits of the dead. Well, guess what? They really did, quite a number of them. And the places that this was done were these places called oracles of the dead. You can read about them in Homer's Odyssey. Herodotus, the historian, wrote about it. Plutarch, the historian. Strabo, the geographer, many of the ancient Greek writers wrote that they had these places where you could go and you could apparently see and communicate with, talk with your relatives who had passed away. Well, when I was in college, I mean, it was understood that the Greeks believed this, but it was just absolutely incredible. I mean, nobody really believed that most people believe that this was just some kind of legend that people had passed down.
Thomas Edison missed it because he was trying to develop his little phone to communicate with the dead, remember?
That's right. And back in about the mid-70s, a Greek classical archaeologist went to the place where many of the Greek classical writers said that this place was, and very quickly found it and excavated it. And what it turned out to be was this big underground facility, kind of like a hospital, kind of like a temple, and kind of like a theater, really. And you stayed 29 days down there in complete darkness in dormitory rooms. And on the last day, they led you into this subterranean chamber about 50 feet long. The archaeologist found in there carbon marks on the walls showing that they had torches on the walls. And at the end of this thing, they found an enormous bronze cauldron that was surrounded by a banister. And the archaeologist looked at this and figured, well, this was fraud, that they had these people down there 29 days. By then, they could sort of figure out what kind of person it was who they had come in hopes of seeing, and their idea was that the people who worked there would get in this cauldron and pretend to be the spirits. Well, I thought two things. Number one, this place was in continuous operation for 1,000 years at least. Secondly, these people were the people who invented reason. The idea that they would have fallen for a millennium just was a non-starter for
right.
me. But more importantly, from my knowledge of psychiatry in the late 80s, I figured out what they were doing. And that was that, you know, you can still in the Middle East today, they'll take a silver bowl, they'll highly polish it on the inside, they fill it up with olive oil and get in a darkened room by candlelight. And under that circumstance, when you gaze into the depth of the olive oil, you actually see full color, moving, three-dimensional visions. And I knew this already, so when I read that detail about what the archaeologist had found, I put two and two together, and in 1990, I set it up right here in my own home. I invited 10 of my graduate students of psychology to help me out on it, and very quickly, some medical colleagues of mine who heard about what I was doing got interested, and they wanted to do it too. And very quickly, I found that you can build a room where it consists just of a mirror on the wall, placed high enough on the wall so that the person sitting in a chair in front of the mirror does not see his or her own reflection. That's very important. This is not a matter of reflections. You can surround this mirror with a black cloth hanging from the ceiling to exclude light. Put a chair in front of the mirror and a little lamp. Actually, candlelight works best around in the room. And after a period of preparation, where basically what I do is I get the people to tell me about the person who had died, to bring up their memories and so on.
You're not playing the part of a medium here, are you?
No.
Okay.
No. A medium, by definition, is an intermediary.
Okay.
That is a person who contacts the dead on behalf of someone else. But in this case, people have their own direct experiences. What they do is, after you prepare them and get them to talk, they sit in this room, and I leave them in there for about an hour and a half. They sit in that darkened room, and when they look up into the mirror, due to the indirect illumination, it's like looking out into space. You don't see any reflections. It's just like going to infinity.
Right.
And under those circumstances, about 50% of the subjects on the very first attempt will tell you that they see and communicate with a departed person from the other side.
50%.
This is so wild, too. Some of the things, I mean, incidentally, what I'm telling you now has been confirmed by multiple other investigators.
Okay.
For example, Arthur Hastings at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology in San Francisco, about 12 years, they sent a crew out, or a couple of people out to my place to learn how to do this, and they took it back to their place, and they're having tremendous success with it. So this really does work, and in many of the cases, the people will tell us that they see the image of their departed loved one forming up in the mirror, but then the image actually seems to emerge from the mirror, come right out into the room with them. About 30% of the subjects will tell you that they actually seem to hear the audible voice of the deceased. Almost all the rest of them who don't say that they actually hear an auditory sensation will nonetheless tell you that they have heart-to-heart or mind-to-mind communion with the person who has died. And this is all wrapped up in a sense of reality. In other words, these people are awake, and by and large, they experience this visitation as a real event. Notice that I didn't say that it is a real event. I say that from the perspective of the subject, it's a real event. They actually say that they feel the presence and see and communicate and be in the presence of the person who's died.
Oh, and that's the most important thing. If they feel this,
that's right.
That's to me it works.
That's right. Because what it seems to do, George, is that it seems to help people through grief. That was one of the great one of the big reasons why the ancient Greeks apparently used this to they would go there if they were grieving the loss of a loved one. As Plato tells us in one of his books, he says that many people went to these oracles of the dead in the hopes of unions to rejoin their loved ones that they were grieving for.
Assuming it works, Raymond.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can.
How
say
does
that.
It work?
It does work.
Okay. How does it work? Why does it work?
Now you're into an area where, George, I just don't have any idea. I have done this, and I got to say, I just don't know what that was. It really seemed like my grandmother. It really did. I heard her voice. I felt her presence. I just don't know what to tell you that was. And I am a genuine skeptic in the sense that I just don't draw conclusions. I mean, why do you need to draw
conclusions? It takes a while, but once you go, you go.
That's right. And so, but what I'm impressed by is that generally the people I bring here and take through this procedure, they don't say, you know, I thought I saw or I had this image. They say, I was with my husband or wife who passed away or whatever.
Do you have to go into this environment wanting to deal with a specific entity, or do you just go in there?
No, I don't believe you do. I set it up that way because as far as I could tell, that was how the ancient Greeks did it. But at least that's how it appears in Homer and in Herodotus and so on. So that's why I started doing it that way. But actually, I've had a lot of people come by who don't have any particular person they in mind that they want to see, but they come here on a more general, just like sort of approach of seeing what happens or seeing who comes through. But George, even the people who are prepared by talking about one particular person they want to see, in many cases, some other deceased person known to them, in addition to or rather than the person they prepare to see, comes through. So that seems to suggest, as you talk to these people, that you don't necessarily get what you wish in this situation, but that you tend to get more of what you need. In other words, people say, in reflecting on it, they say, well, you know, I came and prepared to see my husband, but probably the person I really needed to see more was my father, and so that's what happens. So it doesn't really go along, you know, necessarily what people would want, as to rather what the psyche seems to need.
Can any of us build this kind of area?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, George, this is so amazing. I mean, you know, to me, it's just so amazing all the things that were common knowledge 150 years ago, say, are now relegated into the, you know, into this realm that they seem absolutely extraordinary. If we were propelled back 150 years in time into the United States, everybody knew about this. It was a folk custom, and I have some old Halloween cards, for example, from about 100 years ago, where this is portrayed, people looking in mirrors, and they see the spirits coming up and so on. I don't know if you happen to see that movie Cold Mountain a couple of years back, with the filming of the Odyssey, in effect, but set in the context of the Civil War. And they show this, and there a young woman looking into a well and through a mirror and seeing a spirit come up in the mirror. But this was just common knowledge.
Okay, give us the schematics again for this, Raymond. How do we build this?
Well, first of all, the first rule is, don't worry too much about how many inches this way or that way or exact measurements. It's more of a situation of getting a comfortable environment. You can take a closet in your house or a little room, just sort of drape
the windows
with dark cloth.
Okay, and the windows have to be covered.
Or, you know, at night you can put shades on the windows. Probably best to do this in the evening when things are getting a little quiet. You just put a mirror on the wall. The one I use is about 4x4, but it doesn't have to be any particular size. It's just a good thing to use a size of mirror that will will occupy a pretty good portion of your visual field. You can use even a very small hand mirror, but the images won't be.
And you sit in front of this mirror, totally dark.
About, say, 3 feet in front of the mirror. Get a comfortable chair like a recliner so you can push yourself back. Get if you use candlelight, be sure to be very, very careful, obviously, not to start a fire. But if you want to avoid that, you can get a lamp with a maybe like with one of those Tiffany-type lampshades or something, you know, that makes mutes it a little bit. Get yourself a dimmer switch and put that on the circuit so that you can adjust that light in the room to your specifications, and get a partner, somebody that you trust very well and who's a good judge of you and a wise person. Yeah, it doesn't have to be a psychotherapist, but just the point of your helper there is just to, they will tend to think of questions to ask about the loved one who has died that you might not necessarily think of yourself, and this just talk over the person you lost for a couple of hours with your friend, and then go in there and gaze and see what happens.
All right, now how far do you sit from the mirror?
Oh, say about 3 feet.
3 feet. Yeah. All right, and the candle, where do you put that?
That's behind the chair, or you put the candles around in a position so that you don't see their reflection in the mirror.
Okay, but the light is in that room.
Sort of drifts up and or diffuses around and gives you a sense of depth in the mirror.
All right,
you position the mirror in such a way that you don't see your own reflection. That's very important. You're looking up into it, and you don't see reflections. You just see a depth.
So you're not looking at yourself.
No, you're looking. You're positioning the mirror so that you're looking up into it, and you don't see your own reflection.
Okay. Okay, so you've got the mirror a little higher up on the wall, not the ceiling. You don't put it up there, do you?
No.
Okay.
No.
And the light, how do you know how much candlelight, for example?
That is a matter of different people have different...
What's the mood you're trying to find, then, with the light?
Just to get yourself very comfortable. The flicker kind of helps. And to get the illumination in such a way that when you look into the mirror, you don't see reflections, but you see an illuminated depth.
You got to put the sketch up on your website, Raymond.
Kind of like when you're looking, you know, if you've ever been in a place where you look into a clear pond, for example, where the sand on the bottom is colorless.
Well, it's got pennies or something.
Complete depth, like just a depth. Instead of anything you can focus on, it just is a depth going off into the distance.
And how long does it take before you start to get some kind of reaction?
Well, it depends. I leave people in there for about an hour, and some people say it starts right away. Some people it takes the time. Some people it doesn't happen on the first attempt.
Did anybody ever come out screaming?
Never.
Okay.
Never. But, of course, you know, I mean, it's a matter, I mean, I suppose you could get it that to happen if you wanted to. I mean, you could set the mood where people are going to see something terrifying.
I was going to say, what are the I'm going to tell you about my Ouija board non-experiment when we come back. But what are the dangers, Raymond, of conjuring up some kind of evil entity?
You know, George, I just don't take that seriously for this reason. Mirrors have been manufactured continuously for 6,000 years. They're in every house. You got several of them. Everybody looks into mirrors multiple times a day. I mean, wouldn't you think that if there was any danger of gazing into a mirror, we would know it by now?
True.
I think this is something that is part of human nature. It goes back thousands of years. It's been in every culture and every civilization has known about this. It's the basis of a lot of our literature. The movie Titanic and the movie What Dreams May Come.
Oh, I love that. With that one with Robin Williams. Hold on, Raymond, and we'll take the break and we'll be right back. And we're going to take your phone calls next hour. Well, I'll be back with more with Dr. Raymond Moody in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And if you need information on what we were talking about, this method to communicate with the deceased, you can call Dr. Moody next hour when we take your phone calls. What's your take on mediums, Raymond? You know, Harry Houdini didn't believe much in them.
Well, I got to say, I don't really have enough information to make an assessment, George. I do think this, that I have known quite a number of people over the years who don't make a show of this. They don't charge money for doing it. They're just people who are known in their neighborhood for having some sort of gift along those lines. And I am much, much more impressed by people like that that I've known than performers who do it professionally. And you and I both know that you can go down to the magic shop to get a book to tell you how to do this if you want to fake it. But that doesn't mean that there aren't people perhaps who do have some sort of talent that most of us lack. I just don't know what to make about that. I don't know.
A couple of weeks ago, I planned to do a Ouija board experiment. I am a believer that the board is a toy. It's the individual that has the ability to conjure up. And so I was about ready to do it, Raymond, and then I stopped because one of my guests convinced me that this could harm other people, people who are listening to the program. And I just decided, you know what, if he's right, I don't want to be the one to have to do that. Was that a good call on my part?
Well, you are doing the better part of valor is just as you did, maybe to be cautious. But in my way of thinking about it, I mean, you know, George, again, I mean, if you think about it, how realistic is it that somebody can be harmed by something you can get for $9.95 at the Toys R Us?
I agree. Okay. That's what I wanted to prove.
Exactly. You know, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, this is, it's kind of unrealistic, I think, to say there's some grave harm to be done in a Ouija board. I mean, I'm pretty familiar with the psychiatric literature. I've never known any cases of anybody who, you know, had any harm came to them from from a Ouija board, and I would be amazed to unless one fell off the shelf and hit you in the head,
which is possible,
that it could really be harmful.
Well,
I mean, I can't see it myself.
Which I guess we never know what's out there, huh?
Yeah, that's right.
That's very possible.
The mind is such a wonderful mystery. I relish the mystery of the mind. I think some scholars go into scholarship and try and the search for knowledge because they want some sort of certainty or they want the answers. But I have never been that kind of person. I realized from when I was very, very young that I would never know the ultimate answers of life. But what I really love is the pursuit, the finding out wild and interesting things just holy mackerel. I mean, the rate at which knowledge is exploding now and all the amazing things that came to light. When I read my first astronomy book when I was 7 years old, and I remember reading about the galaxies, and there was a speculative part in the book about the possibility of planets circling other stars. And some astronomers said, oh, no, you know, that Earth is practically unique because it was probably another star came by and ripped out some gases, and that's how the planets condensed. And, you know, some people thought along those lines, and they thought probably planets were very rare. But what this book said was that whether there are or aren't planets circling other stars, we'll never know it for sure because there's just no way of detecting things that small at those great distances. Well, the last I checked a couple of weeks ago, there were already 240 exoplanets discovered, and they're discovering more every week now.
Oh,
within a few years, there will probably be tens of thousands of other planets detected. And
it's endless, Raymond.
It really is endless. And the Planet Finder satellites going up next year, I think, are going to start. They think will even detect Earth-sized planets around nearby solar systems. So we are in for the huge adventure in the next century or so. I mean, of course, there's no real rational way, I think, to make the determination whether there's inhabitants of other planets or not. But so you have to just go, my gut instinct has always told me there's got to be. I mean, to me, it's just practically incomprehensible that out of all of these trillions of planets that we know that there are now, that this little 8,000 mile in diameter rock would be the only place. I mean, I think that's to me far more difficult to comprehend than that life is probably a process that crops up lots of places, I would think.
Do you believe that they may have visited us?
I have no idea. I have no idea. I started reading the flying saucer books when I was about 8, but as I like to say, I mean, I've been looking at this from the time I was about 7 to the time I went to college, actually. Multiple nights every week, I would just lie on the grass and look up at the sky and looking through a telescope and everything. And I saw so many things. I mean, you know, that, let's put it this way, I've seen so many UFOs I couldn't possibly believe in them, because you see the wildest things in the sky, and then sometimes you could just say, now, what in the name of God was that? But then maybe 10 years later, you'll be looking and you'll see the same thing from a slightly different angle, and then it'll just click into place. And, oh, I know what that was that I saw. So my point is, I've read the books, and all, but I'm unconvinced that there's any evidence that we've been visited here before, but I sure do hope I'm wrong.
That's the skeptic part of you.
Yeah, I just hope to heavens that I'm wrong. I mean that would be just the I just really do hope that I'm alive when the absolutely irrefutable discovery is made of sentient beings in other worlds. I mean, that will be the year zero. Now, everything will change at that point. Religion, science, the way people think about themselves, everything will change.
Well, I think so, too. You know, you've seen a lot of things in your life, especially with what you've studied and investigated. What's the weirdest thing that ever happened?
Let me see.
Or strangest?
I think I'll tell you a pretty wild thing that happened. I moved into this home I'm in now, which is an old grist mill that was built in 1839.
What state are you in?
Alabama.
Okay.
And this is way out in the country. Well, I found this place in 1990, and I moved in, and it had last been rewired in 1950. So I knew it needed rewiring, but at that time I didn't have the money to rewire it.
Okay.
So 3 years and 4 months later, in September of 1993, my wife said, well, we can get the money together now, but we didn't know an electrician. And I swear to you, the following chain of events happened. We stood by our kitchen sink and we held hands and we prayed that God would send us just the right electrician. Okay? The next morning, the phone rang. And a voice on the, my wife picked up the phone, voice on the other end of the phone said, "Hello, this is B.R. Wilson." And Cheryl said, "Yes, B.R., well, what is it?" And he said, "Well, your number just came up on my beeper."
Weird.
Uh-huh. And my wife said, "Well, we haven't made any phone calls this morning, B.R. What's this all about?" And he said, "Well, I'm an electrician." Now, this is absolutely the fact. And so Cheryl said, "Well, you know, B.R., we do need an electrician. Come on out." Within about 2 hours, he was out here. He was doing his inspection. And when he finished, we went out on the porch. I sat down on the porch, and Cheryl escorted B.R. out to his van. Within, I'm sure, less than a minute, they were back up on the porch. I remember my wife being white as the proverbial sheet, and B.R. kind of shaken. And what had happened was that as Cheryl had put B.R. into his van, he said, "Well, it's going to be a couple of days before I can get out here to do this, because I come from a very close family around here. We all love each other very much." And he said, "And my 38-year-old brother dropped dead of a heart attack the other day, and my mother had a heart attack on the way home from the funeral home." And Cheryl said, "Well, B.R., my husband might be able to help you with that. He talks with people who've been through grief and so on." And B.R. said, "Well, my mother has given me this book called Life After Life." Now, B.R. is, even after that, 14 years ago now, B.R. is our best friend in this community. So, you know, what do you make of things like that?
I know it.
And, of course, from the...
And it's not luck. It's
no, no. From the point of view of the causal order, it's a coincidence. But why in the 14 years or 17 years that I've lived here has never since then an electrician called, you know, saying that his number? I mean, what do you make of something like that? I don't know.
Fate. Mm-hmm. Fate makes these things happen, Raymond. I'm convinced of that.
Yeah.
When you don't push it, it really just happens. When you're in this groove, this wireless internet that may be out there, it happens.
Life is just so impossibly weird, isn't it?
Yep.
The things that you you entertain as thoughts when you're a child, and then you see them just magically come to fulfillment in your life. And I just, it's a weird, weird process.
You know, it convinces me more than ever when events like this happen that there's something on the other side. There's no doubt about it in my mind.
I can honestly tell you, George, even after all these years of thinking about it, I still have no idea. Because, see, the only way, I am a rationalist. I've been that way since I was about seven. I am also a mystic in the sense that, you know, I've had experiences and so on that impressed me very greatly and that I take seriously. But in terms of making determinations about truth or falsehood of things, I am really at heart a logician. I taught logic. I love logic. One thing people don't know about logic is that the very code of logic that we use came here from the other side. I know that's so weird to say, but the fundamental notion of truth of logic is truth, which was formulated by the philosopher Parmenides in about 500 BCE. And Parmenides got the notion of truth from the other side. He went on a shamanic journey to the other side where this goddess revealed to him the notion that some things are the case no matter what anybody thinks about it, the notion of truth. So logic itself sort of comes here from a spiritual realm, if you are to believe the people who set it up. And so I am a rationalist, and that's the only way I have really of coming to a fair approximation of as close as I can get to feeling confident about something. And I think that the question of life after death is just utterly beyond our code of logic.
So even at this point, the thousands of people you've talked to, the experiences they've had, you still haven't convinced yourself?
Nope.
that there's life after death.
I think that the real reason is that, you know, what do we mean when we talk about it? We think we know what we're talking about, but that is a very, very difficult notion to figure out what that means. I mean, it involves how the mind is related to the body. One of the biggest questions of philosophy is how in the name of God is the conscious awareness that we experience inwardly, how could that possibly be related to the material substance of the body?
But you're 63, and I hope to God you live another 40 years, that you go into the hundreds. But are you saying, Raymond, that you, when you go, eventually, we all will, you're not sure what's on the other side?
I really don't think so. And not only that, George, from the people I talk to who tell me that no matter how articulate they may be, who've had these near-death experiences, they come back and they say, absolutely, there just are no words. They say, all of these words that I'm using to try to put this experience into words for you, they just don't stack up because it's something you cannot even get a vague sense of until you experience it yourself. So I'm just, to me, you know what I've the lesson I've gotten more than anything else from these near-death experiences is that I want to pay attention to this life that I'm leading now while I'm here doing it. You know, one thing I try to do, now I don't do this all the time and I fly off the handle sometimes at people and stuff in ways that I wish I hadn't and all, but what I have been practicing ever since I first started hearing these things, and I'm getting better over at it over the years, is that as I go through the day, I try to just habitually put myself into the place of people with whom I'm interacting.
Yes.
Because,
to try to understand what they're going through.
And to really try to discipline myself to do that, to be kind to people. Because let's say this is real, but I do have this experience, then the best thing I can be doing here on Earth is not trying to figure out something that's probably incalculable by the logic we have, but rather trying to apply myself to make it so that assuming this is what happens, that I will have a better life review rather than a worse one. That's the way I try to look at it. And the more energy I devote to that, the more I see that really, I mean, what does it mean to say that when people tell you they saw everything that they had ever done in full color, three dimensions, and simultaneously experience the impact that their every action had had on the people with whom they had interacted, and that this was all in the presence of a being of complete love and compassion who helped them sort of understand this review, and that it all took place in no time at all. Like my friend Vi Horton said, Raymond, you could say that this experience took 1 second, or you could say that it took 10,000 years, and it wouldn't make a bit of difference which way you said it. And I think I take that very seriously. In other words, that what people tell me is that no matter how good an idea you might think you have of this from hearing it from people, that in the reality of it, I mean, it's just absolutely inexpressible.
All right, Raymond, you stay with us for the final hour. Phone calls, questions, stories, NDEs. You're next with Raymond Moody on Coast to Coast AM.